I've been joined by John Oates. John, thanks for coming by. It's good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here. First time at Bonnaroo. This is a cool deal.
You've got a lot going on right now. I want to talk to you about a good road to follow. You've also got the special jam session tomorrow night, and we want to get the inside dope on that. But I wanted to start off talking to you, and it's always interesting to hear it from a musician or an artist's perspective, how you got introduced to rock and roll, you know, the early records you were buying, what you were listening to. So take us back to those early days growing up in New York and Philly.
Well, I have to take you back to the earliest of early days of rock and roll, because fortunately for me, my childhood, early childhood and awareness of rock and roll coincides with the beginning of rock and roll. I actually remember music pre-rock and roll. I know I'm really dating myself, but whatever. I remember Johnny Ray. And I remember he did a song called Cry. And the big deal with Johnny Ray was he would sing this song Cry, and he would fall on his knees and rip his shirt off. And it was almost a precursor to rock and roll. It was in the early 50s. When I was a little kid, I sang as a baby, literally. So the first thing, when we moved from New York to Pennsylvania, my parents took me to an amusement park, and I believe it was 1954. And I saw Bill Haley and the Comets. They played in a band shell at the Willow Grove Amusement Park, and they played, you know, Rock Around the Clock and all that. And what struck me as a little kid was, at one point, the bass player, in true rockabilly fashion, put his upright bass on the ground, and he rode it like a horse. And I thought that was so cool, and it had left an indelible impression on me. But, you know, afterwards, I, of course, you know, as I got a little bit older, I began to take guitar lessons at 5 and 6 years old. Yeah, I know, I should be better, but whatever. But I would buy 45s, go to the little, you know, we had a little five and dime that sold everything, kind of a hardware store that sold everything in this little town I lived in. And I'd buy 45s, and I started with, you know, the Everly Brothers, Don Gibson. You know, country music was almost mainstream where I lived in Pennsylvania. And then, I got into Little Richard and Chuck Berry, of course, and all the early rock, Elvis. So that really formed the basis of where I was coming from as a little kid. And then, you know, as I got a little bit older, I got into the folk revival in the early 60s. And I discovered all the traditional American music that was being rediscovered and reintroduced through the colleges. I had a friend whose older brother went to college, came back with all these esoteric, you know, rediscovering, you know, records of, you know, people like Mississippi John Hurt and the Child's Ballads and, of course, Joan Baez and early Dylan and, you know, the Weavers and all that kind of stuff and Dave Van Ronk. So I got into that really heavily. And it was always been a blend for me between the rock and roll R&B side of me and the folky traditional acoustic side of me. And to this day, that's exactly what I still do. I really do the exact same thing. You know, one night I'm wearing a shark skin suit and playing R&B. Next night I'm wearing a, you know, t-shirt and jeans and I'm playing the folk blues somewhere, you know. So it's been kind of like a little dual personality, but that's, I guess, if you had to distill what I'm about, that's it.
Tell me about when you first met Daryl Hall, and when did you figure out you two could work together and make some pretty fantastic music?
Well, I met Daryl. Daryl Hall had a group called the Temp Tones, and they were basically a five-part harmony group, just like the Temptations, a cappella. And I had a group called the Masters, which was basically a rock and roll combo with, you know, drums, bass, guitar, sax, and that kind of thing. We had made a record when I was in high school. Daryl's group had made a record, completely independent of each other. We didn't know each other. They were both being played on the two R&B stations in Philadelphia in 1966, in the summer of 67. I had heard his record, and he had heard my record, and we were aware of each other, but we didn't know each other. We were both going to Temple University, and we're actually performing. we got invited independently to perform at a record hop. Which was basically a teenage dance in those days. And a gang fight broke out in West Philly, and we were backstage with Howard Tate and the Five Stair Steps, and we all went down the service elevator together, and that's how we actually met, believe it or not. I know, sounds like I made it up, but I'm not that bright. But so that's we got together, and I actually joined Daryl's band, Daryl's vocal group, as a backup guitar player, because two of the guys in my group got drafted into Vietnam, and then so the group was basically over. And I joined Daryl's group, and then his group broke up shortly thereafter and kind of left us together, and we kind of gravitated toward each other. I think we both recognized a certain amount of talent and things. But when we first started singing together, it was horrible. We went to Temple University radio station, after hours, and I was a communications major, and I got some free time at the radio station, and we made a tape of this really crappy song that we wrote, and we sounded so bad. We just looked at each other and we go, this will never work. Why don't we just hang out? We'll be roommates or just whatever, you know. And little by little, you know, we kind of melded this thing together, and he brought his kind of urban doo-wop thing and his classical training. I brought my folk and, you know, rootsy rock and roll thing. And really, I think, you know, here again, if it is this hybrid of the music that Hall & Oates created over the years, is some unusual hybrid of that, all with a, you know, with a taste of Philly thrown in.
Yeah, because I remember, you know, listening to the radio, you know, the first like FM progressive station I listened to, and you would hear, you know, like She's Gone, you'd hear some of that early stuff, and then of course you had this incredible ride. What goes through your mind when you turn on the radio or you're somewhere and you hear something like, you know, Sarah Smile or You Make My Dreams or Man Eater? What goes through your mind?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm proud of all the records we made, and not just the hits. You know, I think that's a misconception that people seem to have about us, is that we're and Daryl and I are very, very adamant about this. We're very much more than our hits. Our hits were a byproduct of a lot of hard work and good craftsmanship and inspiration. You can't plan on hits. Everyone, you know, people accused us back in the 80s when we were having this ridiculous run of number one records that, you know, we were these pop meisters who could just churn out number one records. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? If you could make a number one record, everyone would do it. It's not that easy, you know? It has to happen. People have to discover it. It has to be in sync with kind of the zeitgeist of the moment. It has to be good. It has to be catchy. There's all these elements that have to come together. It's really hard to do. I think Daryl and I are way more proud of the albums that we made, because we took just as much care with the albums that we did the singles. The singles were actually a byproduct of the albums in that they were chosen by the record company, not us. We never chose singles. We never said, oh, this is Man Eater, let's release this. This will be a number one record. We just made the best records we could, and the ones that seemed to be radio friendly rose to the top.
Yeah, I don't think it was ever released as a single, but it was at Head Above Water. That's one of my favorite songs.
Oh, it's an awesome, yeah, great song. I mean, I just got an email yesterday that HBO is going to use a song that I wrote called Alone Too Long, which is a really obscure track from, I believe, that Silver album. And no one ever plays that record. And they're going to use it as a theme song for one of their new series, which, like, I thought, really cool.
Yeah. All right, you're here, going to play tomorrow night. It started out as the Soul Super Jam, but now they have changed it to the Rock and Soul Dance Party Super Jam. Now, you've hooked up with Jim James from My
Yes,
Morning Jacket.
Absolutely.
Ziggy from The Meters.
Yes.
I believe Larry Graham.
Yes.
Now, a lot of people are speculating, since they changed the title of it, you and Jim and Ziggy and Larry are bringing on some special guests. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to spill the beans.
Well, I'll tell you what. It's an amazing group and amalgamation of unbelievably dedicated and gifted musicians and singers. The core band itself is off the charts. What we tried to do is we blended some elements of My Morning Jacket with some of the guys that I work with on my solo projects. And with Zig was really the core of this whole thing on drums. Larry came on a little bit later, and when Larry came on, we realized he was going to be obviously a featured performer. And we went in a very strong Sly and the Family Stone direction, which is a very good place to go, especially in the middle of the night at Bonnaroo. Then as the word got out of what we had going on, a Preservation Hall Horns jumped on board, and then other guest artists began to reach out to us saying, hey, we want to be part of this. Thus, it became the Rock and Soul Super Jam Dance Party, whatever. Billy Idol's going to come out and do Bang a Gong. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. R. Kelly's doing something with us. And we have a surprise guest that I'm not allowed to say. But trust me, it'll be worth the wait. Larry Graham is a force of nature. He came to this thing saying, we told him, Larry, you know, because he's got Graham Central Station. Larry is as contemporary with his music as I am with mine. But we both respect our legacies, and I think that's important. And Larry came at it in such a cool headspace saying, you want to do Sly? Let's do it the right way. Let's really do it. And man, I want to tell you, This is, and in a weird way, my career has been leading to this moment. I don't want to sound too hippy dippy and too metaphysical about this, but in a weird way, all the things that I've done, playing with Daryl, meeting and going to the Uptown Theater as a kid, and seeing all the great soul artists and rock and roll artists and playing with them, and all those things somehow has led me to this point where I feel really comfortable being the music director of this incredible group of musicians. And it's an honor. It's an honor for me to be chosen to be the guy, you know, it's a lot of nuts and bolts stuff. I'm not trying to, you know, shine my sheriff badge, but it's a lot of hard work, and months of work have gone into this, but only 2 actual days of rehearsal, which is the really insane part. And it's fantastic. And I wish if I had a watch, I'd be looking at it, because I can't wait to get on stage tomorrow night.
Fantastic. Let's talk about this project you've got going, A Good Road to Follow. I think this is really a cool way to get music out. First, tell everybody, if they don't know already, what the project is all about and how you're putting this music out.
Well, the project is called Good Road to Follow, and it's a musical journey. It's a musical road. For some reason, the themes of my last few solo albums were 1,000 Miles of Life and Mississippi Mile. And the word mile kept popping up, and traveling and moving forward in the road. I travel all the time. I tour all the time, whether it's solo or with Daryl or whoever. It just has become a way of life over the years that now it's not an unusual way to live. It's my normal way of living. And there's something about pushing forward that appeals to me. And so I started thinking about, you know, taking it further than just the actual songs and the music itself. I started thinking about the modern world and how people listen to music, how the way that music is a part of people's lives, in that personal playlists, personal selections. Music is no longer being force-fed by you know, music critics and by the media. It's really all out there. It's this incredible, vast resource of music that people can choose from. And I thought, well, why fight it? I don't think the world seems to have the attention span to listen to big pieces of long-playing music. And I think it's almost gone back, in a way, it's gone back to the singles that we spoke about earlier, which for me is perfect. I mean, I feel very comfortable in a world of singles. That's how I started out. And so I thought, you know what, I'll just do singles. And so in doing that, it freed me up in a lot of ways creatively, because I thought, well, wait a minute, I don't have to make an album. If I'm not making an album, there doesn't have to be any sense of continuity or consistency or flow or style. And I can explore all these amazing types of music that I enjoy and these incredible friends and collaborators who I've met along the way. So that's what I've done. I've enlisted all these amazing people. The first single just came out a few weeks ago with Hot Shell Ray. Hot Shell Ray is a great pop band based out of Nashville. But they are a state-of-the-art 2013 young pop band. And I've known those boys since they've been like 5 or 6 years old. I used to write songs with their dad, Keith Falsey, who's an amazing, legendary songwriter. And they're incredible guys, and got together with them. We wrote a song in the studio. We recorded it together. It was purely 100% collaboration. It was really fantastic. And I said, I want to go into your world. I want to make a modern pop record the way you make one. And in doing so, I kind of brought my kind of old school pop sensibilities. And the next one that comes out in July is with Vince Gill. And I asked Vince about, you know, if he wanted to do something like that. And what I think what appeals to a lot of these really creative, busy people are that I'm not asking them to tie up a lot of time. It's just, if we write a great song, let's just record it together and I'll take it from there. And Vince said, it's all about the song, as you know. And I said, you got that right. So we sat in his living room and about 45 minutes came up with this amazing song. And I said, does it make the cut? And he said, sounds good to me, let's record it. And we literally recorded it in his house the next day. So I did one with Ryan Tedder from One Republic, Tommy Sims. Did a song with Sam Bush and his entire band, really cool Americana kind of bluegrass type song. So I get a chance to explore all the cool stuff that I really like. Did one with Nathan Chapman, who produced Taylor Swift. And we actually recorded it in the same room that he did all the Taylor records in. So every song has a vibe and a theme and a whole you know, a whole life unto itself. So they're going to come out on a monthly basis, and eventually I'm sure they'll be compiled into something, whether it's an EP or an LP.
Fantastic. One of the, and they can find out more at your website, johnoates.com.
Yeah, johnoates.com. iTunes has it. Yeah, supposedly it's out there. Wherever records are not sold is where you can find it.
One of the themes here at Bonnaroo this year is album art, and we have picked a 1975.
How retro of you.
Yes, yes. We're asking people to talk about one of their album covers, and then we're going to ask you about your favorite Beatles album cover and the Beatles in general. So we have one from 75. It was just Daryl Hall and John Oates. It looks like you're going through an androgynous phase there, John. Who took the picture, and what were you trying to convey with that album cover?
What do you mean we?
Okay, somebody.
I'll preface it by saying, what do you mean we?
Okay,
let's just put it into the context of the time. We had just moved from Philadelphia to New York a year or two ago. The androgynous thing in New York was big at the time. If you look at albums of the same era, you'll see Todd Rundgren and the Rolling Stones and Derringer and all these albums that are very kind of similar in vibe. And what happened was, and it's interesting that you chose that album, because we've made 26 albums, and that's the only album that cover that anyone ever talks about. And when we wanted to do this kind of really, we didn't know what we wanted to do. We just wanted to be like in the groove of New York. And we met this guy named Pierre LaRoche, who was the Rolling Stones stylist. And he was a Frenchman living in New York, very flamboyant, I might add. And he said, I will immortalize you. Little did we know. But here again, that's the only one you're talking about. And he did. And one of the top fashion photographers in New York took the picture. We did the makeup. We did the whole thing. And we just went with a vibe. And we didn't really think too much about it. There wasn't a lot of thought process involved in this. We just said, here we are, do us up. There we are.
Well, I don't mind saying this, John. You're a very handsome man on that cover.
Yeah, thank you.
The Beatles.
Yes.
A Beatles fan, I'm sure.
Well, interestingly enough, I was not actually a Beatles fan. I really got turned on to the Beatles rather late, because living in Philadelphia at the time when the Beatles started, Philadelphia didn't embrace the Beatles. You couldn't dance to the Beatles' music. If you couldn't dance to music in Philadelphia, people weren't interested in it. They actually boycotted the Beatles on Bandstand because it wasn't danceable. And I was into R&B. I was into wearing suits and stuff. It wasn't cool to like the Beatles at first. Of course, I went back and realized the brilliance that I had overlooked. I got turned on the Beatles after Sgt. Pepper. That's how late I came into it. But having, obviously realizing the incredible, the iconic everything from the songwriting to the performances and the recordings. I have to say that I really like the Meet the Beatles cover, or the With the Beatles cover, as you call it. I like that Richard Avedon style, kind of shaded face thing. In fact, I've used that myself on a lot of pictures. There's something very iconic about it. It's graphically balanced. It's just got this very, very cool thing about it. And, they've got the early Beatle haircut. The whole thing is just very incredibly, incredibly iconic. And I just love it.
Well, I got to tell you, John, it's been a gas to meet you.
Thank you.
And it's been fun to have you come by. A good road to follow. Check out johnoates.com, and you can get all the digital singles. The big jam sessions tomorrow night. We've heard some of the special guests, and there's one that John says we're staying up for.
They're telling me I'm not allowed to say anything, so I'm keeping my mouth shut. But trust me, you're going to like it.
And give you one chance to do it here, and we can...
No. Okay. I won't do it. I won't do it to the Bonnaroo folks.
It is
They've
Kiefer.
Been good to me.
All right. It is Kiefer with John Oates. We are backstage at Bonnaroo.